So, hi Joseph. G'day. Welcome to Fremantle Shipping News.
Thank you.
I'm talking this morning with Joseph London. Joseph is the director and producer and everything else in relation to a documentary that'll be shown in Fremantle. When will it be shown, Joseph? Can you give us an idea of the date?
Yes, it's the screening is on Saturday, December the 12th at 11 a.m. And it will be, it is a 4.5 hour film. So, and there will be two intervals of 15 minutes each, I'm told. So that means it's ostensibly a 5 hour film.
Wow.
Or a 5 hour experience from go to woe.
And the subject matter?
The subject matter is Fremantle's Rajneesh Sannyasin community and movement. Its okay. history and its aftermath, I suppose, is okay. one way of putting it.
Okay. Well, we can talk much more in detail about the documentary itself in a moment, but I'm curious to know a little bit about your background. You're a Fremantle boy, originally?
I am. My parents, in their search for a place that was not suburban Perth, but not commune living in the bush, found a place in Fremantle in 1976, which was right in the middle of Fremantle. And so I was born in 1978, and so I grew up in that period of change in Fremantle, I think, where that transition from a working class Italian fishing village, pretty much, changed into, I suppose, more of a tourist destination with the arrival of the America's Cup and the gentrification process and the desirability of Fremantle as a home to artists and musicians and, I suppose, you know.
So you surfed that wave as a young boy, I guess.
So, yeah, we were exposed to a lot of what was happening in the surrounding streets of Fremantle at that time. And as part of that, I went to the local school, South Terrace, which is now Fremantle Primary, and they and that became the school of choice for the Rajneesh Sannyasin community, which had really established itself here from 1981 with the purchase of a building in central Fremantle on Collie Street and the leasing of a trades hall building, which became the ashram or centre, as they called it.
What got you interested in filmmaking?
My parents are both crazy about film, my dad especially. He is an architect by profession, but his passion behind that has always been film, and so he always exposed us to a lot of world cinema. I think he would take us to films when we were young, European films and art house films, and always bring films home for us to watch and just really encourage us to watch them all together. He put a lot of value on that experience. And I was actually, and so while I was interested in film, and I was really interested in acting. I did acting at John Curtin. I had not really decided on a career as a filmmaker until I went overseas after high school, and I needed someone to enrol me in a uni course when I got back, and I was way too disorganized and my head was elsewhere to concentrate on this. So Has that ended the recording? No, it's still going. So actually my mum enrolled me in film at Curtin while I was away. And that turned out to be a very astute choice of hers. I mean, I must have discussed this with her on my, you know, weekly or fortnightly phone call I made back then. Communication wasn't as easy back in 96, but yeah, it was her that enrolled me, and I started film, and I immediately felt that this was a medium that satisfied my interest in storytelling, in creating worlds and atmospheres, and it just held in it cinema a lot of what deeply interested me, I think.
Okay. So basically there'd be a lot of people that think about going into some creative career, but filmmaking, most people would think it'd be a pretty tough gig, particularly in a place like Perth to get started. So where did you focus your attention? Was it really on doing something here, or did you ever contemplate going away to continue with that?
I really wanted to make something that I felt was a representation of how I saw things before I went away, and I did do a stint away. I lived in Germany for 9 months when I was 30, or just before I turned 30, and I was doing all sorts of odd jobs to survive, and while the city and all it offered was extremely stimulating to me, I felt I wanted to get on with my work, and I was held back from that by what I had to do just to pay the rent. And so my preference for a long time was just having a job that I could more or less put to the side and concentrate on developing my craft, I suppose. Okay. So writing myself, and then as time went on, it became clear that it was preferable for me to also shoot myself and produce myself.
I think I must have been almost 10 years ago that I met you, and at that stage you had a project in mind. It was a bit different to the one that actually we're going to be seeing fairly soon. So can you describe what that was all about?
Yeah, so this project sort of has been swimming around in my head for a really long time, just because there was a mystery from my childhood that I never understood, and the friends of mine who were involved in the movement, there was their story about the Rajneesh movement was also a little bit muffled and not really clear to me. So it really is a mystery from my childhood that I wanted to delve into. But it wasn't just the Rajneeshis initially. It was the other mystery, and I think possibly we all have something from our childhood that we want to return to and get a better understanding of. And for me, it was just that time before the America's Cup, where there seemed to be a lot of exchange, you know, open exchange of ideas and cultures and energies in Fremantle that really intrigued me, and that was the initial motivation, particularly the collision of Italian and Rajneesh cultures that that were particularly juicy and full of hilarity, actually. Like, there was a lot of really funny stories. But it changed because in my sort of initial research, I discovered how, well, first of all, how large the Sannyasin story was, and then also it was, people had fleeting memories of that time. They remembered little incidents, but there wasn't a kind of a narrative to stitch it together. And the Italians I spoke to were also very respectful on camera. Not that they were disrespectful off camera, but they were. But when on camera, they didn't really like to, you know, be too. Didn't want to make admissions that would in any way be derogatory to. They're very respectful, even if they had questions about their fellow. Townspeople at the time.
So cutting to the chase, you actually thought there might be a bit more juice in just concentrating on the Sannyasin side of things, huh? Yeah.
Well, that's right. And there was a big story, and I felt if I was just concentrating on the Italian and Sannyasin story, then there would be a lot of really deep and difficult material that I was glossing over that I didn't feel able to do somehow. And I also felt the Sannyasin story allowed me to explore a film style that interested me as well, that was about voice and landscape and how in somehow place is suffused with its past and the various meanings that it has on the people that dwell there.
Yeah, that kind of segues into the question I was just about to ask, because obviously you locate the film in Fremantle primarily. When you started to conceive the project, that was the kind of approach you took. You wanted to get a storyline, but you also wanted to locate it and get a sense of place. Would that be a...
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it happened here in a big way. And I was interested in that in itself, why that was. I remember in the early days, people were talking about how there were rumours that Fremantle had special ley lines that allowed for such movements and happenings, spiritual happenings, to occur here. And as a native of Fremantle, or, you know, someone who is very attached myself to Fremantle, that interested me also, but it was very hard, and I included such kind of questions and angles in my interviews initially about that subject, but very hard to it's very hard in interviews and in spoken expression to somehow capture that. So in a way, the form of the film addresses that.
Yeah, so that's really through the actual photography and the movement that occurs in the actual sequence of narrative suffused against the backdrop of Fremantle. Would that be the way you wanted to bring that specialness, I suppose, might be describing it?
Well, I mean, it's not, I mean, just firstly, as a description of the film, it consists the landscapes that we've discussed are these long static setups of a single location and just allowing time to suffuse in that location. So you see traffic change, birds, people moving through the frame. It might be another one where you see clouds move across the frame. There's just, or fishing boats move in and out of the frame. So there's this kind of ongoing life that occurs in these windows of Fremantle. And I reached that, like initially it started with very slow pans, but they were very hard to pull off. And I always would return to the long static shots. So they became longer and longer when I would go out into on location and press record. I would really have to hold back on stopping because I would always get back and find that I would have preferred to have more.
Yes, well, at the same time you were doing this, you approached a number of people who had been involved or were still involved with the community, and you interviewed them, you've mentioned. Do you want to describe that process and how you went about
it? Yeah, initially I advertised on the networking sites for the community here, and so I suppose the first people I interviewed were people still, were sannyasins who were very connected still to the to the whole ethos and world of sannyas in Fremantle, and I had it was all volunteers initially who came forward and offered their views on things, and that took me into all sorts of really interesting worlds and homes and personalities, and that's a whole process I've really enjoyed, and it's been a long process now. I've got to know everyone in the film quite well, and then I was introduced to a number of former sannyasins as well, and that was a different perspective again, and it was clear that this was a history that for which there were many ways to interpret it depending on the personal experience of the disciple or ex-disciple.
So when you accumulated all this interview material and you had to sift through it and distill it and condense it and edit it and take pieces from it and string it all together into a movie. Describe that process, because for those of us who don't make film and don't really know how this goes about, it would be interesting to hear.
Well, this was a painstaking and quite murderous process that took years and years. And I really, there was long periods of time where I just couldn't feel the pulse of this film, and I didn't know where I was taking it, and I didn't know what I wanted to concentrate on, and there was a constant question behind what it was that I was looking for here, and I think what started to emerge that was of most interest to me and most the issue that needed most clarification was the issue of discipleship and what that's about, and how and why it seemed so foreign and scary to me, actually. This whole the whole concept of surrendering to another person who is not equal to you. And so that became the focus in terms of the emergence of the uh, the emergence of this philosophy in the lives of sannyasins that came to it, and I think that was the backdrop to why it was so important mm-hmm. and why people followed this. And so that really needed to be established clearly.
And brought out in the actual documentary, you mean?
And brought out in the documentary, yeah. So they were the... So I started, you know, pulling out the parts of the interviews that spoke to
addressed
that.
Addressed to that, yeah. And just interjecting there for a minute, just to give any listeners a bit of a... that haven't been familiar with the particular guru that we're talking about here. This was... Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh, who later became known as Osho, and the disciples are known as Sannyasin. So I just want to throw that in at this stage, because there will be listeners perhaps who aren't familiar with that, even though most of Fremantle
probably is. That's right. And I mean, you're obviously very the perfect person to speak about it, but as a summary, this was someone who emerged in the 70s at a time when I think Westerners were really looking for a bridge to the East and a bridge to that form of mysticism, and they found in Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh, or Osho as he's now known, an extremely articulate ex-philosophy professor who had, according to many, become enlightened, had some large event take place in them spiritually, and so had developed a personal charisma, and also spoke perfect English. So he not only that, made Eastern mysticism extremely attractive to Westerners who didn't like the strictness of Buddhism and liked to hear that they could get enlightened by having sex. Or well, that was certainly one of his many ideas.
I find it interesting because here are you, a sort of a... You're the age of my children, 40s and... those of us who were around this particular person are a generation before you, and it's interesting to have a pair of eyes looking at that phenomena with a generation difference. Partly that's what makes, I think, the movie so interesting, because you're looking, you've been involved with a lot of these kids who were the children of sannyasin parents, as I understand it, at the time. So you've seen a lot as an observer looking in, and now you've thrown yourself into the mix completely and immersed yourself and have come up with something. And in doing that, what were the challenges in formulating the final product for you?
Well... I mean, I talked about the issues that really needed to be made clear, such as discipleship, but I also needed to create a storyline.
Mm-hmm.
And so particularly for part one and part two in the documentary, I needed to tell that story of what happened in early involvement in the move to India, the move to America, which also instigated all the moves back to people's sannyasins' home countries, which is when the ashram in Fremantle was established. And then what happened then, which was this crazy period of... where Bhagwan was in silence and Sheila, his secretary, a very extremely powerful and provocative character, really took the movement in a direction, or apparently took the movement in a direction that left a lot of sannyasins to question their involvement, and a lot of outsiders to believe that it had moved into dangerous territory.
And you focus in that storyline because I think that's one of the real strengths of the documentary, is that you tell the story and you don't do what, I mean, many of us have seen other documentaries that really abbreviate or cut short some of the discussion around the progress of that story. And whereas you have given it much more time to unfold through the voices of the people that you've interviewed. Can you describe, was that a deliberate kind of act to really make sure the story was full rather than truncated?
Yes, absolutely. But of course, there's much in the story that is left out too. Mm. There's no mention of Rolls-Royces, which was a big...
Was that because you particularly wanted to bring out the Fremantle community of San Jacinths and their experiences and what was happening in either Pune or later on when the whole show moved to America and Oregon? Did you really want to keep the story back here?
Well, I should say that the other story and issue that really stuck out to me from speaking to everyone was the aftermath.
Mm.
And the fact that once the movement, once the commune in America collapsed,
mm.
and the commune in Fremantle also collapsed at the same time, and San Jacinths were publicly discredited, mm-hmm. and they let go of the colours and mm-hmm. basically blended back into mm-hmm. the wider community. That was the big story that happened mm-hmm. for me in the making of this film, because everyone in their own way experienced some sense of displacement
mm.
and disconnection and even trauma,
mm-hmm.
and it led to all sorts of interesting interpretations of what it meant to be a disciple to this guru, and how they were going to live their lives from then on.
Because this aftermath that you talk about, this is an ongoing thing, the aftermath. I mean, we're now, I think Osho died in 1990, so we're 30 years after his death, and many of the people that were around are considerably older,
yeah.
and yet the flavours certainly linger. So you've brought in a contemporary documentary that's dealing with a lot of past history.
Well, that's right, and I think that's important to state as well, is that all the landscapes are contemporary landscapes. They're what we're seeing now. So I suppose that's also, and I touched on this before, about the persistence of history and memory mm. in place,
mm.
and particularly memories that are difficult to process. And there is, and so that combination of voice and landscape really... is about historical processing and coming to terms with things that are difficult to understand,
yeah.
and what I've included in the final film are the things that I felt were the most important things to deal with in order to understand the history of the San Jacinths, and that's not just my research. I think that also goes to my experience of growing up with San Jacinth friends and their households and meeting, you know, all sorts of different people who are involved in the movement at various stages in my life.
And you've made use of footage that you've obtained from other documentaries and TV programs and...
there's a lot of archive that people wouldn't have seen before, and some of that is stuff that I've been allowed to use from the community itself, from, you know, I guess, home movies and, you know, private internal community videos that were made at that time. But there's also a lot of stuff from, a lot of material from 60 Minutes and the ABC, mm. because it was, you know, there was a saturation of material on the Sannyasins at the time when, you know, they really entered the public consciousness for a period, and we were everyone was following the saga of the Sannyasins and the rise and fall in many ways.
Well, it's certainly a saga. We're going to have to wrap this up in a moment, Joseph. I mean, there's a lot to talk about, and certainly for anybody that has their interest triggered by what they've been hearing, from what you've told me, it's going to be shown on Saturday, December the 12th at Luna Essex.
Mm-hmm.
I think you told me earlier that there was a full house in terms of Cinema 2 there, but the theatre are trying to ensure that there's another screening at the same time in another theatre. Is that the current state of play?
They've opened up another cinema, I'm told. And
where can people get tickets if they want to get tickets?
They can get tickets via the Revelation Film Festival website. I should have said that. It's part of the Revelation Film Festival.
Yep.
Or through Luna. And I'm told that there will be many people in their orange and red and parlours attending, so it will be an experience on a number of levels.
Well, that shouldn't deter anybody from coming along, and
it should encourage them.
Perhaps getting an insight into something that was certainly had a presence and an importance in Fremantle, and a lot of people perhaps have misconceptions about it, and by seeing this particular documentary, they'll have a chance to really absorb the story from woe to go, in a way.
I hope so.
Thank you for coming in, Joseph, and
welcome.
And good luck with the screening.
Thank you.
Bye-bye now.